The Guardian.
Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Zan Brooks. This week, we take a sideways look at the future of cinemas as UK venues widen their remit and look beyond the movies. I meet Mark Allenby from Picture House Cinemas to discuss the future of the silver screen and the mystery of alternative content. Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw will be joining me to review some of the week's releases, including Cars 2, Horrible Bosses, Beginners, and The Big Picture. It's as dramatic as a Commons Select Committee inquiry, though hopefully without the pie man. It's Film Weekly. Now, I suspect that most visits to the cinema sound like this. But now you might just as easily hear this. Yes, Wimbledon live in 3D is just one example of alternative content in theatres up and down the UK. In fact, figures released this week reveal a huge growth in profits from cinemas hosting live theatre, operas and prestige sporting events. So is this a financial lifeline for cinemas or a distraction from providing film to film fans? I'm joined by Mark Allenby from Picture House Cinemas. Welcome to Film Weekly, Mark.
Thank you. Hello.
Mark, maybe you can start by kind of explaining the reasoning behind this enterprise. How has it kind of come about?
I suppose ultimately what we term alternative content, which is non-film content in cinemas, came about with digitalisation of cinemas. So when we moved away from 35mm prints and went to digital equipment, it suddenly opened the floodgates in what else could be shown in a cinema screen. And along with satellite technology, alternative content was really born.
So tell me about this alternative content. What kind of things are you offering?
Really, it's a broad breadth of offering. I mean, we at Picture House focus on the arts. We look at operas, ballets, live theatre and so on. But really, it's limitless. Any event across the world which has a sort of sellout or has a global appeal could ultimately make it into a cinema screen.
So what kind of thing are we talking about if the sky's the limit?
Well, I mean, you're seeing sport, you're seeing music. We're doing things around book launches. So we had Stephen Fry last September doing a Dickensian reading of his latest book, and then that was broadcast across cinemas within the UK. We're doing the same thing with Michael Moore this October. So it's, you know, any event which has an audience, really.
Well, what's the USP here? I mean, previously, you know, we've assumed that people go to theatre to see theatre or to a sports stadium to see sport if they're not watching it in the comfort of their own home. Why should they go to the cinema to see these things instead?
I think it's not always available for people. So, I mean, I guess that's the USP. It's creating availability and allowing content to have a broader audience. You take the Met Opera, for example, from New York. It's not many people can go to New York to go and see the Met, but here's an opportunity for them to see it affordably and you know, locally in the comfort of their local cinema.
Is it a kind of leap of faith for audience members? If they're kind of unfamiliar with this as a new mode of exhibition, how are they reacting? What kind of feedback have
you had?
I think
initially it was a little bit of a leap of faith. Increasingly, audiences are exposed to this and aware of it. I mean, we've been doing it since 2005. We've had huge success with Bolshoi Ballet, NT Live, one-off events as well. And more customers have been exposed to it. I think initially they weren't sure what to expect. There's always a comparison. What is it like against the live experience? But, you know, by and large, it's been seen as very positive and people come back for more once they understand what to expect.
How does it compare to the live experience? I mean, what is the etiquette in a cinema? Do people applaud? Do they, you know, what?
Absolutely.
Or is there still a kind of distance because it's on a screen?
I think the distance is really eroded. And ultimately, the audience you'd expect to find at the live event basically come to the cinema event. So at opera and ballet, they'll sit very quietly throughout and applaud at the end of scenes. In football, they'll stand up and cheer and sing. And anywhere in comedy, they'll laugh along with Stephen Fry and so on. So it really, you know, it's just an expansion of what is already happening and the audiences respond accordingly.
Is there a downside in this, that the alternative content in cinemas comes at the expense of smaller films, that sort of old classics or niche interest foreign language pictures?
We don't think so. I mean, there's certainly more films being shown across Picture House than ever before, again, partly because of digital technology. And you can also look at what we're also doing, say, with Picture House Entertainment, where we're now distributing and releasing films which otherwise wouldn't have been seen. My Afternoons with Marguerite last year was a success for us, and that was a film which other distributors weren't going to pick up. We thought can work, and we released it like you would alternative content. Ultimately, you know, we can talk to that audience and get it into our screens, and we were proven right.
But it's a quota system, though, presumably. I mean, you've only got so many places to show films that if you've got these live events there, that must squeeze out films that might otherwise be playing.
Yes, there. But ultimately it's one-off events. And so if you think about a film traditionally having 28 shows, I mean, it's not taking that much of the screen time away. Often we try and get it into more accessible times or down times and program it accordingly. And again, yeah, we don't program by numbers. We really try and make sure the screens work for us and have audiences in all the shows. And so that's very much part of it.
What kind of percentage of your business do you think that this will account for in, say, sort of 5 years' time?
I think it's hard to say. Really, but I mean, for us, it's a nice extra alongside film. Film is clearly still the staple of what we do, but we really see this as an opportunity to, you know, bring in new audiences, push them to film, and also, you know, just make sure the cinemas aren't empty places. It's also worth, I guess, when talking about film, looking at how the technology has also enabled film to be better received. And with that, we often do satellite Q&As. So we will film a director in one cinema and broadcast that across the country, again, using exactly the same technology. So that's really enhancing the film market and, you know, allowing films a better opportunity to really talk to their audiences.
If you had a wish list, I mean, you talked about opera, the Bolshoi Ballet, sports events. If you had a sort of wish list, dream list thing, and you could screen one live event at Picture House at some stage in the future, what would it be?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure the answer. I mean, personally, I'd be interested in seeing Crystal Palace play, but I don't know if there's really an audience.
That's niche interest,
yeah, exactly.
Though,
niche interest every Sunday morning, I think.
Mark Allenby from Picture House, thanks so much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thank you.
A big thanks to Mark Allenby from Picture House Cinemas, and for more information on all of their events, visit their website, picturehouses.co.uk. Now let's retreat to more cosy, familiar territory and tackle the bread and butter business of film releases. Peter Bradshaw, Guardian film critic, joins me to review some of the moving pictures on offer this week.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hello.
Peter, this week we'll be reviewing Horrible Bosses, Mike Mills' Beginners, and The Big Picture. But let's start with Cars 2, Pixar's sequel to the 2006 tale of talking motors and the joys of old-time Americana. On this occasion, Owen Wilson's intrepid race car is venturing further afield to Japan, Italy, and London, where he's snared up in the most rambunctious espionage plot this side of Austin Powers.
Kochirae, dozo. Come with me, please, sir.
But I'm gonna miss my plane.
Right this way.
Oh, doggone it. This is about my hook, ain't it? I know I should have checked it, but I can't miss. Look, it's attached to me. Hey, I know you. You're that fella from the karate demonstration.
I never properly introduced myself. Finn MacMissile, British Intelligence.
Toll Mater, average intelligence.
Peter, I know that you're a Pixar enthusiast, but where does Cars, the franchise, sort of fit on the grid?
I don't think it fits in pole position, to be honest with you. I think it's one of those movies that, since it came out in 2006, like many people with young children, I have been forced simply to upgrade it incrementally because it's one of those films that you are forced to watch over and over and over again with your little kids who love it.
And that upgrades it for you. That doesn't make it worse and worse and worse.
Well, you kind of absorb their reverence for it in a way. When I first saw it, I thought it was pretty moderate, really, and nowhere near the top whack of what Pixar could do. I have been forced to kind of grow to love it in a funny way. Cars 2, I thought, was very, very average sequel. I thought the idea of it was a real shark-jumping kind of premise. There was none of the kind of down-home heart that the first one. It just immediately went abroad, and it had, I don't know, nothing of very great interest. Toe Mater, his buddy, had been upgraded really to the star of the movie, but hadn't really all that much interesting to do. Lightning McQueen himself was almost an incidental character. I found it really quite average, to be honest with you. Although, as I say, once we get the DVD out and my little boy forces me to watch it 100 times, maybe I'll come to love it as well. I don't know.
What was better about the original Cars for you?
Well, the original Cars had a real situation in a kind of real place. Except that it's not a real place, but it had that, I don't know, there was a sense of place and community and Lightning McQueen coming to terms with everybody around him. Cars 2 shoves the people involved, the characters involved, into a series of tourist locations, unimaginatively rendered, I have to say. And I have to say, with a note of patriotic kind of spleen, that I thought the drawing of London seemed to be pretty bad, particularly the drawing of Big Ben. I thought it almost looked like the opening titles of Have I Got News For You? It looks so, it just didn't look very good.
But it's Big Bentley, isn't it? It's the sort of carification of a London landmark.
Yeah.
But Does that excuse it?
No, not really. It didn't look like it had been transformed into something else. It just looked that they'd wonkily drawn Big Ben with no very great interest in what it was they were drawing. And I felt, as I sometimes do in my little England away, that sometimes when Hollywood sort of tackles London and England, it gets it wrong in a kind of annoying way. I mean, they sort of get it right with Michael Caine and Emily Mortimer voicing the kind of car spies working for MI5. That's sort of getting it right. Although a very boring role for Michael Caine, nothing very interesting for him to do. And the character, Finn McMissile. Mm. I mean, when Austin Powers brought back Michael Caine, it was in a very sophisticated way of saying, look, we know back in the day, Michael Caine was a kind of super hip, kind of spyish kind of guy, but now he's old. Now, cast two seem to have no way of absorbing that into Michael Caine's persona.
It's interesting you mentioning the bad design, because Pixar movies are normally known for superb I mean, you know, you think of the 50s suburbia in The Incredibles, say, or Paris even in Ratatouille.
Yeah.
They normally get those details right.
They usually get it absolutely right, but I felt that there was something weirdly cursory about it, especially with London. I felt there was something a bit almost casual. I mean, it's, you know, let's get it in perspective. Of course, it's, you know, in the round, technically it's sort of brilliantly done in the way that every Pixar movie is. But I felt that there was something a bit casual about it. It's sort of, I don't know, running on empty a little bit.
But you know, as you've admitted, you're probably going to end up
watching this a hundred times. As I say, there's going to be I've written about this. There's a PhD or something to be written on the nature of films which are destined to be rewatched over and over again, every frame of them fanatically scrutinized by people in a way that adult artistic films are not. So maybe, who knows, Cars 2 will come up.
So as a film critic, I mean, presumably you must get asked this question 100 times over, like, what's the film you've seen the most? And now, presumably, with a small child, you will know.
I think definitely no. It has to be either Cars or Finding Nemo, or maybe The Incredibles. But I think it has to be Cars. I've seen it, I think, at least 20 times.
Bergman's got nothing
on
Finding Nemo.
Winter Light, no.
Peter, let's move on to a very different film. This is Beginners, which stars Ewan McGregor as an LA graphic artist who's tenderly concerned for his old widower dad, Hal, played by Christopher Plummer. Except that Dad, it turns out, has a long-buried secret he's now eager to share. He's gay.
Well, maybe you should take out a personal ad, you know, where you can explain your situation.
My situation?
Yeah. I mean, you want to be in a relationship and you can't stay in one.
That's your fatherly advice. Personal ads.
Well, a lot of people use them. I did.
What?
If Andy wasn't going to be monogamous, why should I be?
Bob.
Yourself.
Peter, director Mike Mills made the very offbeat, kooky Thumbsucker a few years back. Is Beginners in a similar vein?
Yes, it is. It is, and that's a good thing. Its quirk factor is very high, and I'm not quite sure whether it sort of breaches my quirk ceiling. Mm. I think it kind of does. But what is very bracing and kind of great about Beginners is its sheer high IQ. If you didn't know that this was by Mike Mills, if you settled down to and thought it was just going to be a sort of a heartwarming romantic comedy starring Ewan McGregor, you would be surprised or even astonished at the sheer high IQ sheen of what comes up on screen, those quirky still images, narrative voiceovers, a sort of also quasi-Godardian kind of funk that's laid on for you. It's actually a very bracing experience, and I liked it. I thought it's kind of clever stuff, and Christopher Plummer has, in a way, never been better. He's very charming and warm. There's something in the movie which I think is kind of high concept. It's a kind of high concept indie movie. And the high concept, of course, is that this kind of mixed up guy who earns a living writing kind of irritating, kind of passive aggressive cartoons discovers that his dad is gay and has been gay for all their married, all his parents' married life, and all his life. That this is a secret with his dad, and a secret buried inside himself. And that in a way, his quirky humour, which I think Mike Mills' film sort of shares, is a byproduct in a way that he hadn't understood of this dysfunctional situation.
It's a supposedly a semi-autobiographical that, yes, Mike Mills had the same,
yes,
revelation. I mean, does that add intriguing kind of texture
it
and detail to it?
It sort of does. With so many films which are clearly autobiographical in the way it is, you sort of want to stop it and say, goodness, can we hear the real story now? This is interesting. It's been interestingly transformed and deflected hither and yon in a way that you find comfortable, Mr. Mills. But could you think you could tell us the real story? Not that this isn't fascinating in itself, because it is. Although, as I say, there's something a little frustrating about the Ewan McGregor character, the Mike Mills character, because he is a kind of almost a literary character, a narrating character who does, in Martin Amis's phrase, he's the one who does all the noticing. He does it all, he narrates it, he notices everything, but doesn't react. Sometimes the camera will turn onto Ewan McGregor, and I'm thinking, what is he going to say or do or feel in response to these extraordinary revelations? Is he going to get angry with his dad? No, he just looks sort of bemused. He has that...
It's all going on behind the eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing's happening. What, you know, give us something, Ewan. What do you think? And I don't think it's... I don't think it's a criticism particularly of Ewan McGregor or even of Mike Mills. In a way, a kind of blankness is plausible in a way because he would be sort of paralysed by the continuing astonishment that he very possibly is feeling. But there is something I found at the centre of it slightly frustrating because I thought, you know, what is his reaction to all these extraordinary events? We're supposed to react, but his reactions are being, I think, slightly disingenuously kind of fed out into a series of ironic slants on everything. And the central and I think fascinating revelation of the movie that everything about him, his witty, quirky style, is founded on, this is a style he's absorbed from his mother, who developed this style as a way of denying what was happening to her. All these things are fascinating, and yet there's something I think slightly disingenuous or ungenerous about the centre of the movie, which is Ewan McGregor.
But also at the centre of the movie, there's this great, the great revelation that we have about parents in the dawning realisation that they're not just our parents, that they have secret lives and secret longings and something entirely independent from us.
Yes, that is the thing that you find out when you have children yourself, in a way. That it's not simply that he finds out his dad is gay. He finds out that his dad is sexual, in a way, not just homosexual, heterosexual. He finds that his dad has this sexual identity which exists entirely independently of his family role. So it's interesting. I wish I could love it more than I do because it's really beautifully made. It's beautifully shot. It just looks so crisp. They're superbly elegant, the way in which scenes are slightly reimagined in slightly different clothing and replayed for us. It's elegant and stylishly made. It really has a very high IQ, and you feel yourself sort of toned up in a way by it, especially if you sat down to it expecting it to be any other Hollywood kind of dross. But as I say, I wish I loved it more. I wish I felt that there was a killer punch from Ewan McGregor's character.
That's Beginners by Mike Mills. We move on now to the Big Picture, a French take on a novel by Douglas Kennedy. This stars Romain Duris as a hotshot Parisian lawyer at a crossroads. On the face of it, he has it all. But a whole new avenue is about to open up.
T'as fait ce qui pouvait m'arriver de pire. Tu m'as enfermé dans une bulle. Et t'as fait ça pour que je me plante. Parce que les ratés aiment les ratés. Voilà, c'est ça qui s'est passé. C'est ça la vérité.
Attends, stop, on va trop loin là.
Qu'est-ce que tu racontes?
Attends, ok, je te demande pardon. J'ai pas eu la bonne réaction, je comprends.
Peter, we're constantly told that Romain Duris is one of the great French actors of his generation, though he always looks to me like he's just kind of wandered in off a Vogue Homme photo shoot.
Yes.
And that's a problem for me.
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, he does look like that in a way that he's one of these guys who can look good with no grooming at all, unless his grooming is so brilliant that it's sort of
that's
evades attention.
My suspicion.
Well, he's a good performer. He's a star in the sense that he doesn't play anything other than himself. He has slightly French teeth, I think. He has like Mathieu Amalric. He has kind of slightly alarming teeth, I often felt. This is a good movie. It's slightly preposterous. It has a reasonably sized plot hole, which I can't discuss without getting into spoiler territory. But suffice it to say that the book was written before the ubiquity of global online image searching. Now, that's as far as I can really go. The new film version, the book was written in 1997, so in fact the internet was hardly unknown. But nowadays you have to kind of bring that into account in a way, and the movie sort of does and sort of doesn't. But that doesn't hinder the fact that it's actually very enjoyable. I found it very. It was just. It kind of rattled along. It really did rattle along. It's got a classic, almost Chabrol-esque kind of thriller premise, and then it moves into something else more like Patricia Highsmith territory. It's enjoyable. There's a rather stately cameo from Catherine Deneuve, who can sometimes look as if she's sort of thinking about something else when she comes on. And I felt that she really was thinking about something else for about 90% of the time.
And she's just there because she's Catherine
Deneuve.
She's there,
but yeah, she's just literally wheeled on and wheeled off. And then, again, another sort of playing himself type of a cameo from Niels Aristrup, who almost has a kind of father-son two-hander routine going with Romain Duris. He was in the Odiar's The Beat That My Heart Skipped.
And in Prophet.
And
in
Prophet, with another younger guy, of course. He plays an aging French scallywag who bumps into Paul, that's the name of Romain Duris' character, and kind of takes an interest in him. Again, I don't want to go into too much because it'll kind of spoil it, but it's a little preposterous and a little silly, but it's done well, and it rattles along. It's very watchable.
Horrible Bosses now is a wish-fulfillment Hollywood comedy in which three downtrodden wage slaves team up crisscross and scheme to murder their respective employers. Here's lowly Jason Bateman receiving some rather bad news from Kevin Spacey.
I've been in that position for 8 years now. Why would I stay here after being treated like this?
Well, because I'd make sure that nobody in the industry would ever hire you again. Because they're going to want my letter of recommendation, right? So I'm perfectly willing to write that you are an insubordinate, dishonest drunk.
You can't do that. That's not true.
Let me tell you something, you stupid little runt. I own you. You're my bitch. So don't walk around here thinking you have free will, because you don't. I can crush you anytime I want. So settle in, because you are here for the long haul.
Peter, let's look at those horrible bosses then. We've got Kevin Spacey there as this sort of paranoid Machiavelli type. We've got Colin Farrell as the sort of coke-fueled Satan. And we've got Jennifer Aniston as the oversexed dentist. If you had to work for any of those monsters, which one would you choose?
Goodness, I don't know. Which one would
I'm
I
not going to offer you a
one
job,
would I
but
prefer to be anyway. I think any of them individually could conceivably be the subject for a David Brent style movie on their own. Each of them are very undeveloped, and I'm afraid the whole movie fundamentally doesn't work. I think there's something fundamentally misjudged about the movie tonally. In that you have three guys who are supposed to be sympathetic. Remember, it's the three bosses who are supposed to be unsympathetic. And yet the three downtrodden underdog guys, they're the ones who want to commit murder. Now, that creates a problem, not an insuperable problem, but a problem of tone, nevertheless, with ultra-dark black comedy, which the movie never addresses, never acknowledges, and certainly never solves. There are one or two nice lines in it, some very funny lines, when they find a bar where they run into this dodgy guy played by Jamie Foxx who advises them on how to commit the murder.
And this is, I mean, we can say this because it is his name. His name is Motherfucker Jones.
His name is Motherfucker Jones. And we find out that he's changed his name from Dean Jones because that's the name of the actor in Disney's The Love Bug. Which I wished this movie might have worked if there was a gag like that every 7 seconds. But they can't. There are about three like that, and the rest of them are, as I say, it's a movie I suspect that's kind of got off the ground because of the success of The Hangover. So there's a kind of hangovery vibe for the guys, but also alongside this pretty broad knockabout humor, there's something which is clearly trying to be a bit like the American TV version of The Office. It's clearly trying to absorb some of that, and there's a mismatch there, frankly. Colin Farrell playing the cokehead asshole guy who has a kind of comedy fake Bobby Charlton comb over could have been funny, but his part was terribly underwritten. There was really nothing for him there. I think Jennifer Aniston actually wasn't bad as the as the sex pest dentist, she could have been good. If only the whole movie...
Is this the role that she was made for?
I think it kind of was. She wasn't bad. If the whole thing had been about her and she'd been really allowed to let rip and she was the one kind of shouldering the burden of the black comedy comic heroism, that would have been great, I think.
Peter, let's end on a high note because we've got a couple of raves from the graves out this week. We've got the re-release of the great Ealing comedy Lavender Hill Mob, with Alec Guinness as the timid clerk who robs his own bank, and we've also got Gilda.
I found him, Gilda. Very elusive chap, our Johnny. Sit down, Johnny.
Good evening, Mr. Farrell. You're looking very beautiful.
Good evening, Mrs. Munson.
Can't you return the compliment, Johnny?
You're looking very beautiful.
Why, thank you. If there's anything I love, it's a spontaneous, impulsive compliment like that. And because you're so nice, I'm going to show you something. My husband gave it to me for a coming home present. Is it cute?
50,000 pesos and it's cute. Isn't she fabulous, Johnny?
Fabulous.
Wait, Johnny.
Gilda is this fantastically kind of mad film. It's this fantastic melodrama stroke noir set in a very exotically imagined Argentina, just before... VJ night, actually. It's just before and just after. And then there are lots of weird things going on. It's very odd. It looks almost exactly like a kind of weird bizarro version of Casablanca. There are so many things in it that look like Casablanca. Mm. But it looks like it's Casablanca without the idealism and the heart of gold. It's a world of paranoia and hysteria and rage and people obsessively telling lovers, ex-lovers, obsessively telling each other how much they hate each other as well. It's quite striking, that line being repeated so often. Rita Hayworth on, you know, superbly, mercurially sexy form as Gilda, who is married to the sinister casino boss in Buenos Aires and who married this guy on the rebound from a certain American guy who turns out to be Glenn Ford's character, who happens to be working at the same casino. So there's this tense, secret, sexy love triangle thing going on. And also, I think, looking at the movie, interestingly, kind of quasi-satirical comments on South America getting ready to forgive, having in fact already forgiven Germany. I think there's something very interesting about Gilda that doesn't get noticed very much. Mm. That all this stuff about Germanic characters and Germany and this quite interesting subplot that he wants to... He nurses these fascistic desires, that is to say the casino boss, to rule the world. He wants to rule it through, of all things, a tungsten monopoly because he thinks that tungsten... is the absolutely vital component for light bulbs. And so he will rule the world. And he might be right. And he's using his casino wheel to pay off ailing competitors. And it's a clever, interesting, and offbeat idea underneath it all. There's this quite interesting thing going on.
That's Rita Hayworth in Gilda, which is re-released by the BFI this week. Peter Bradshaw, thanks so much for joining us on Film Weekly. It's lovely to have you here again.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
And do come see us again soon.
Oh, will do.
Right, that's all we have time for this week. Film Weekly is actually taking a short summer vacation, just 1 week off to stare at the wall and contemplate the point of it all. So Jason Solomons will be back with you the week after next, and he'll have all the answers. In the meantime, The Guardian is conducting research into how you listen to our podcast and what you think of our audio on the site. So if you'd like to participate in a feedback session, all you have to do is email your name and contact details to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. The music featured on this week's show comes from the soundtrack to the sublime Gilda. But for now, from me, Zan Brooks, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.